Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to your Monday Tennis Podcast, where Canada has concluded and Cincinnati has already got underway in earnest. It is that time of the tennis year where the events come so thick and fast that they overlap, and we love it. You find us in very hot and humid climes once again. I've got my air conditioner on, so that's the hum that you can hear in the background, and I'm still sweaty, and there's a hose pipe ban. Who knows what state of showering you will find us in over the course of the next few podcasts. How are you coping, David?
All right. We have had a drop in temperature of about 6 degrees today, to which I am able to exist without being just sat there in a mess. But I mean, it's I do love this period of tournaments. These 1 week mixed tournaments. I said on Thursday that I could imagine just sitting there for 15 hours a day watching these matches, and it's pretty much what I've done. And looking at, you know, then I looked at, Matt sent through the Cincinnati highlights of the first rounds, and again, it's just the same thing. It's just fantastic as a time of year.
And I know we have a bee in our bonnet about this. This is very much pushing the Tennis Podcast agenda. But I do think last week, and I anticipate the same this week, is a great advert for 1 week long 1,000 events.
Yeah, and it's going the wrong way then. Because, I mean, they're actually going to make these tournaments 1.5 weeks, aren't they? And they're going to do the same with Madrid. And I do get it. I understand the point of trying to expand and build these particular moments and names of venues and cities in the calendar and making a big fuss of them. I really do understand that. But it does dilute them, and you do end up with days that are a bit not that bothered about today, or there's not that many big matches on today, and yet every day over the last 5 or 6 days has felt a big deal and fun, and I've got to be there and I cannot move.
Yeah, and one of the selling points of the Masters, or points of differentiation of the 1,000 events over a Slam, is that from basically third round onwards, you have to play back-to-back days. And I know that's tough on the players, but it does make it a different challenge to the Grand Slams. It poses a different question, and I like seeing how players cope with that. And I also like knowing, you know, I've just watched an incredible match with Dan Evans and Tommy Paul. I'm going to get to see Dan Evans again tomorrow. You know, I know he's going to be on the schedule tomorrow, and that's going to be a fun time. I think I get it as well, David, but I think, Matt, you agree. For the viewer, I think this is kind of the ultimate for this level of event.
I completely agree. It's a business decision, isn't it, to change the length of these Masters events, stretch them out over 10 days. I don't think it's great for viewers, personally. I mean, I suppose there are some who will say, OK, fewer matches would overlap. I could maybe watch all of the matches, but personally, I just think buzz is what you want on days and weeks like this, and it's what you get when it's over a week. And I thought Canna did a really good job of scheduling the women's matches and men's matches at slightly different times of day, you know, so you really could, you know, there wasn't much overlap. You could roll from one into the other, and the schedule was packed every day. It was great.
They really lucked out with the, well, not lucked out, it was good planning, I suppose, with the final schedules yesterday, didn't they? They allowed a 2.5 hour gap.
Yes, it was
between
seamless.
The scheduling of the women's final and the men's final, both of which went to three sets, and there was about 10 minutes in between the conclusion of the women's final. You just got to see enough of Simona Halep's reaction and her, you know, doing a quick interview, and then you got to transition seamlessly into the men's final. It was perfection. So Simona Halep, a bit of a giveaway there, the champion in Toronto. She beat Beatriz Haddad-Maia of Brazil 6-3, 2-6, 6-3 in the final, and then over in Montreal, Pablo Carreño-Busta, 31 years old, with the biggest title of his career over Hubert Hurkacz. We're going to start in Toronto, and what was a fascinating week in so many different ways, with so many newfangled things happening, and yet with a very old-fangled champion.
Yeah, it was, and yet a bit of a reboot of Simona Halep this year, but this was the first moment that she actually won a tournament in that year. Lots of promise, and I don't... We kept talking about, between us, how well is she actually playing? Because it wasn't all roses, was it, this week? This wasn't Wimbledon final form that she produced against Serena Williams that day. She had spells of very good tennis, but she was grinding and she was finding ways to win tennis matches. And I actually really enjoy that Simona Halep as well. I enjoy watching a player trying to come back against her when they realise they've got to hit out and they've got to try and hit her off the court, because that's the book on beating Simona Halep. And yet she was just there all the time, particularly at the end of the final.
Yeah, I've been pondering on this. How well is Simona Halep actually playing? And she destroyed Donna Vekic in the opening round, and I saw bits of that and I thought, she really is playing well. This is, you know, close to vintage Simona Halep. But actually, I think purely tennis-wise, I think she might have actually dipped as the tournament went on. It ended up being a slightly weird final. Neither player played well at the same time. It was all about intensity, that final, and not so much about level of tennis. And I actually think it's intensity that is winning Simona Halep tournaments and matches, and now tournaments. And that is what she has rediscovered with Patrick Mouratoglou: hunger, desire, intensity and belief. And there's a lot to be said for that. I do think there is frailty there, tennis-wise. Her serve is extremely vulnerable and just deserts her at times. And I think players are going to punish that. And I do also think her fuse is very short. You know, she can be in command of a match. It's almost sort of Andrei Rublev, like, you think she's in command of a match. She hits a wayward forehand and suddenly she's self-abusing out there. You know, I think she was bashing herself in the thigh two games in to the final yesterday. I do think there's a, you know, if a player can probe at that weak spot emotionally, there is frailty there. But I also do think, and it's evidenced by this week, that the hunger and intensity of Simona Halep is so overwhelming that it can get her, when it's like it is now, because I don't think it's been there for the last couple of years, but when it's at this peak, it can get her an awful long way.
I don't think I have much to add to that analysis, really. Those were all my exact thoughts. The fire is burning inside her again, like it hasn't been for a while. And I think it was after Doha this year where she told her team that she didn't really think she was going to be a tennis player for that much longer, because she didn't think she could compete at the top. And, you know, 6-7 months on from there, we're now seeing her win a Masters 1000 event for the first time in a couple of years, the first time on a hard court in 4 years. And absolutely, it was that intensity, it was that desire, it was that fire that was kind of the defining feature of her, I felt, this week. Because, as you said, sometimes her tennis was brilliant. You know, there were moments there where she was great. You know, thinking the way she wrestled that third set back in the final, and I've just got this image of that incredible forehand passing shot she played right in the closing stages. You know, there were vintage Halep moments in there for sure. But really, it felt all so insecure and a bit fraught the entire week. And as you said, the serve was extremely vulnerable. And thinking back, it was actually the serve in the Wimbledon semi-final against Rybakina, which really let her down. I think she hit about double figures, double faults that day, and she was quite high on double faults this week. It just never felt like any lead that she had was safe, because her serve might just go. She might just decelerate on it and serve double faults and be vulnerable. So, I suppose all of that put together, it made for a really compelling week. You know, she was kind of her own opponent on the court, and yet she managed to overcome herself. Coco Gauff playing really well. She overcame Jessica Pegula playing really well. Hadad Maia really confident. It was a brilliant title victory from her. And yet, I don't know, for example, that I necessarily see this as, right, Halep's going to go and win the US Open as well. It just doesn't feel that secure. It feels like it wouldn't take much for her to get beaten. She's kind of hanging on, and you know, but it was a thrilling, thrilling week.
And the other factor is this bizarre record she has at the US Open. You know, everybody has their favourite slams and least favourite slams, but it baffles me a little bit how much poorer her US Open record is versus the other Grand Slams, because she's obviously a brilliant hardcore player, and I think she's perhaps intimated in the past that she doesn't love New York. It doesn't suit her personality brilliantly. There's also the fact that it's at the end of the year and she plays quite a grinding style of tennis. Maybe it's the balls. But it does create intrigue, doesn't it? Because usually, you know, two-time Grand Slam champion wins one of Canada and Cincinnati, you automatically put that player into the US Open mix. But by the definition of our mix, I still think I'd be surprised if Simona Halep won the US Open. Discuss.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and New York doesn't necessarily mesh with every player. You can be perfectly happy and serene at every other Grand Slam, and then you get to New York and you've got a 35-minute good case scenario journey into the tournament from Manhattan every day and then back at night.
About having a good playlist, David.
Oh, okay. Do share yours.
I will.
But I mean, it's not for everybody, actually. Even if you go back as far as Bjorn Borg, he won everything, but he didn't win the US Open. He didn't like the nights. He didn't like the lights that were coming down, the floodlights. And there have been other players over the years that have just not really enjoyed it as much as the other Grand Slams, whether it be surface, whether it be the kind of heat and humidity that you get in New York. And I do think I can imagine Simona Halep just finding the whole thing a bit frenzied, a bit too much for the senses, just because she brings a lot of her own senses to everything, her own intensity, and that's a lot altogether. I think maybe I would put her in the mix, because I think that it could go the other way. Matt, you rightly say that how long can you hold on if you're not playing that well and keep winning matches? But that form may actually start to come as well. And if she adds her best tennis to this, then I don't know. I think the mix is probably pretty big at the US Open for the women's side, and therefore she would be in it, I think, for me.
Yeah, I think she's in my mix. I just don't think I would be picking her as sort of the number one. But I think she's in the mix, given her experience, given the fact she's won this title, as you said, without playing her best tennis, she might still find it she's in there for me, but New York record and the possibility of it not lasting make her not an automatic pick like you might think she would be.
She made such a point in her victory speech of calling it a team victory. It's my first, it's our, meaning her and Patrick Mouratoglou, it's our first title as a team. We had quite a few interview VTs with Simona Halep over the course of the week, and you know, she would rather talk about Patrick Mouratoglou than herself. You know, she is all in on Patrick Mouratoglou, the church thereof. And look, it is obviously working. It's working. I'm delighted to see that whatever he's doing has lit the fire inside Simona Halep again, because it's a compelling sight in tennis. But regardless of who the person in question is or what the situation is, it does just make me a little anxious, that level of reliance on an external person and a coach. And obviously there's this sort of added dynamic of it being, you know, an older man. It's an uncomfortable aspect of women's tennis, that so often these sort of authority figures that they end up relying on are older male figures. But maybe it's unfair of me to bring this up because it is working, but I find it a bit unsettling. And I do just worry that, I don't know what scenario I specifically worry about, other than, yeah, I find it unsettling.
I mean, I suppose I would worry a bit if, and it sounds like this is the case, a lot of the people who've been around Halep for a long time are sort of no longer quite there. It's all in on Mouratoglou. And as you said, it is working, but you kind of like to see some stability, I suppose. And also, a big thing for Halep her whole career was kind of the whole Darren Cahill aspect was not relying on me, not relying on the coach. And it does seem like there's been a bit of a backward step there in terms of, now I really need Patrick. And look, maybe that isn't a backward step. Maybe it's going backwards to go forward again in terms of, you know, we've spoken about that. That desire is back. But also, I did notice that I think Mouratoglou joined halfway through the week. I don't think he was there for the first three matches. Certainly, I didn't see him courtside.
Oh, and if he's there, you see him.
Well, yeah, exactly. That was my thinking. You see him, you see his hat, you see everything. And I felt like those first few wins, okay, she wasn't playing as strong opponents, but they were actually her best performances. You know, as you said earlier, the way she beat Vekic, the way she beat Zhang Shui, I think Teichmann as well, Mouratoglou wasn't there. Halep looked great, you know, and wasn't getting down on herself so much on the court. In those back-end matches, there was a lot of stress, and they were more stressful matches because she was playing better opponents, but there was also Patrick Mouratoglou sitting on the sidelines. And, yeah, I agree. It's clearly working, but I'm also not going to say it's, you know, really, really all sort of rosy. And
It is interesting, though. Simona Halep over the course of the next few weeks is going to be fascinating, as is Beatrice Haddad-Maia, her first 1,000-level final, the first Brazilian woman ever to reach a final of that level. Of course, 1,000-level events didn't exist when Maria Bueno was plying her trade, but still, an incredible result for Beatrice Haddad-Maia and for Brazilian tennis. She's into the world's top 20. I know we've been getting a bit of flack on Twitter for making Beatrice Haddad-Maia the butt of a joke. Just want to be clear, it is David who is the butt of the joke, and absolutely not Beatrice Haddad-Maia, who I think is a top 20 player to stay. I don't think it's always interesting when a player has this hot a streak, you know, when has this anomalous a set of results over the course of a short period of time. Is it just a hot summer? But I mean, it is a hot summer for Haddad-Maia, but I also do think this is the start of something. I don't know what the end point is. I'm not quite sure yet what her potential is, but she's another player whose intensity, I think, will carry her an awful long way. She's got the demeanour, at the very least, of an absolute top-level player. You wouldn't know what the score is. When you tune in at any given time, looking at her body language, you would not know what the score is. And that is pretty difficult to teach, if not impossible, I think, and a real superpower at the top of the game. You might have been onto something, David.
Yeah, I might have been. But I mean, look, I don't feel as though I warrant any credit for picking her to do anything at Wimbledon. For a start, she lost at the first round. Yes, this happened a month later, and so I'm quite happy to take all the plaudits you want to throw my way for saying she'd reach a Wimbledon final a month ago. But I didn't really know her as a tennis player until this week in terms of what she brought. What I was basing my assessment on, and I often find I do this, I'll look at a player's results and see who she's beaten, who she's beaten and who she's backed it up with, and how long that's taken place, and even what the lopsidedness of scorelines. I think you can sometimes they're misleading. Sometimes you'll watch a 6-4 and it'll have lasted an hour and 20 minutes. Other times, you know, it's nothing like that. But I feel like there was some messages in the runs she had on grass, the depth of the runs that she was going to, and then doing them again the next week against really good grass court players. So this was a great week to find out, for me at least, to discover who she is as a player. And you look at who she beat: Leila Fernandez, Iga Swiatek, Belinda Bencic, Karolina Pliskova. Every single one of those is a top player, has either won the Olympics or won a Grand Slam or been to a Grand Slam final. And she's gone and rolled through all of them. And they're all different types of players, different physical presences that they have. And to use that word, that's what struck me beyond everything with Beatriz had to admire, is she's 6 foot tall, left-handed, not really like anybody else. I can't think of too many other players. I've heard comparisons to Kvitova. I think there are some similarities, but there are also some differences. But she has
she's so much more physical than Kvitova, I think.
Yeah, and she's so much more in the face. She has true presence on the court. Your eye is drawn to her. I don't know whether this is true, because from what I heard commentators saying who dealt with her during the grass court season, she seems to be a really lovely person, great to talk to, very open, very interesting. But on court, she is a killer in terms of the way she's looking over the other side of the net. She looks like she's trying to engage opponents almost with the stare. And I don't know whether that's true or not. It may just be a total coincidence. But I'm watching her against Iga Swiatek. I watched all of that match. Swiatek in the second set, I mean, in high wind, it was really, really difficult conditions. And I thought, God, a player of her height trying to control the ball in this swirly wind is a real challenge, real test for Haddad Maia. But she just kept sort of deliberately staring down the other end and then hitting a big shot and then having another look up. There are some comparisons I would make in terms of demeanour to Garbiñe Muguruza at her best, where she's in there, she's intense literally all the time. There's never a moment where she's taken her foot off. And a good player. I mean, she's at her best, I think she's bringing it. And the few times she ended up at the net, goodness me, she volleys nicely, I thought. Very securely.
I'm a big fan of the stare. I've got to say, I don't think...
No great surprise.
I don't think Iga Swiatek is a massive fan of the stare. That was an utterly compelling match. How much do we write it off as a blip? Perhaps a weather-related blip? The wind was undoubtedly a factor in that match. Or how much do we look for a little bit of a pattern here? The loss in Warsaw, the loss to two whole losses for Iga Swiatek, three if you throw Wimbledon in as well. You know, are we having crisis talks about the world number one?
Well, that's it. I've been writing off her losses. I've been thinking, oh well, it was grass and it was Cornet, that was very losable at Wimbledon. Then it was, you know, first match back in a little while, sort of slightly random tournament on clay, pressure of playing in Poland as the world number one. That was, you could kind of explain that one away as well. And then you get this one, and suddenly you've got the fact that she's lost three of her last six matches. And collectively, maybe they tell a story that she's not in the sort of form that she was in when she went on her, what did it end up as, a 37 match winning streak, I think. That has been so lodged in my mind, that Iga Świątek. I keep telling myself she's that player, she's in that form. I think the evidence is that she's not quite in that form at the moment, and she is a little bit more vulnerable. As you said, it was very tricky conditions. I just expected her to deal with them better. You know, she is the world number one. She has got variety. She was so much overhitting, which is becoming a real trademark, I think. When she doesn't play well, she loses control of that forehand in particular. The second serve is a big, big weakness when it's being attacked, and I thought Haddad Maia attacked it in a similar way to what Caroline Garcia did in Warsaw, really went after it. I think Świątek really struggled to win points on second serve, especially in the final set. So where are we with Świątek? I don't know is the answer. I'm still trying to figure it out, but I think I do need to probably slightly lower my expectations of her. You know, one good win against Aya Tomjanovic and I thought, right, okay, she's back. But actually, this is a period of not brilliant form that she needs to work through and get back to being the player she was earlier in the year.
Sloane Stephens or Elise Cornet first up for her in Cincinnati? Maybe we'll learn significantly more. I feel like that's going to be an important data point, that match, regardless of opponent, about where she is. One last talking point from Toronto before we head to Montreal. Coco Gauff won the doubles title alongside Jessica Pegula. They beat Ellen Perez and Nicole Melichar Martinez in a match tiebreak on their eighth match point. It was an extraordinary conclusion to that match, absolutely thrilling. And perhaps more significant than the title, Coco Gauff, 18 years old, American number two in singles, to Jessica Pegula, incidentally, is now the world number one doubles player. That blows my mind and is something that has really snuck up on me, and it makes me really joyful. I doubt it makes the doubles specialists on tour very joyful, because there's always a bit of needle, isn't there, between the doubles players that, you know, ply their trade at that form of the sport week in, week out, and they think, oh, you just rock up and turn your hand to this when you feel like it. But the thing with Coco Gauff is she doesn't do that. She's really committed to playing doubles. And it's got her to world number one. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, snuck up on me to the point where when the press release from the WTA arrived today to say that she is world number one, I had absolutely no idea she was anywhere near, to be quite honest with you. And I did think that is a fantastic story, really, that she's managed to achieve this. Not least because, and I think this is where probably the double specialists don't mind, is, I mean, it's not like she's just won a few Grand Slams and got all her points that way. She hasn't actually won a Grand Slam title in doubles yet. She's reached a couple of finals, but, you know, this has been an accumulated ranking. Yes, those finals have helped, but it's everything else on top of it. It's showing up for these tour events and playing them consistently. I agree with you. I think it's a lovely story. I think it's helping her singles, helping her development as a player and as a human being. I think all that company and not just practicing all the time. And if you lose early one week, then you've got 5 days to kick your heels and practice for your next first round match the next week. You know, and I mean, I thought there was in a singles game, there was a real difference with the way she played against Simona Halep this time. Yes, she lost, but she'd never got close, really, in a set before. And the big thing was that she absolutely tried to knock Simona Halep off the court. And I just loved seeing this different version of Coco Gauff in terms of aggression and approach. But moreover, I think she just continues to build what she is eventually going to become.
She's the second youngest player to get to WTA doubles number one, only behind Martina Hingis. It's absolutely amazing that she's done it, and I was really pleased for Goff and Pegula that they got over the line. It was a stressful final, as you said, loads of match points. Goff said that her legs were shaking throughout the match tie break. And of course they lost a very tight French Open final, didn't they, just a few months ago. And actually for both of them it was the biggest title of their career, because they've never won at that level in singles, either of them, even though they're, you know, they're absolutely top singles players. And Pegula, I think, is the only player who is top 10 in singles and doubles. And of course, you know, it's not like Goff's doubles is, as you said, it's not hurting her singles. It's only helping her singles, I'm sure. She's number five in the race. She's having a brilliant year. And yeah, those two together make a really good team, I think.
And I hope others take note. And I think perhaps they already are taking note. I notice Emma Raducanu is playing doubles this week in Cincinnati with Elena Rybakina. Yes, please, to checking out a bit of that, by the way. But I was so pleased to see that she's playing some doubles. I think it could be brilliant for her, a loosener, a way of making friends on tour. It must be so blooming hard to make friends on tour when basically you're entering the fray as a Grand Slam champion. You know, that comes with... Is it like being moved up a year in school? No, it's not quite like that, is it? But imagine, you know, having to go into the school canteen as... help me out with this analogy here, Matt. It's like, I don't know, you're just not... You're not on a level playing field with everyone, are you? I can't imagine it's very easy for her to, you know, go up to someone in the players' restaurant and say, you know, do you fancy having lunch together? I know that's not how behind the scenes at tennis tournaments work, but I think you know what I'm getting at. I think I'd be surprised if she ended up doing what Coco Gauff's doing, but I think just dipping her toe in the water, I think it could be really brilliant for her, and I'm pleased to see it, and I'm sure there's plenty of others that could benefit from it as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before we talk more about Cincinnati and in particular Emma Raducanu, which we will be talking about, folks, let's head to Montreal and the biggest win of Pablo Carreño Busta's career. He wrestled this from Hubert Hurkacz, who looked to me to be in very firm control after the opening set. I mean, Hubert Hurkacz just loves a North American hard court, doesn't he? And the fact that it went to three sets, the fact that Pablo Carreño Busta did fight back and win that second set, also didn't perturb me with regard to Hubert Hurkacz's chances of winning, because all of his matches this week had gone to three sets, and he saved match points in one of them. And, you know, that was just the pattern he had developed over the course of the week. And he looked as surprised and bewildered and shell-shocked as me, actually, that he didn't manage to find a way to come through and win that. He was 5-0 in tour finals going into this match. So that is the first time he's ever lost a final. And it looked like quite a chastening experience for him, actually. He looked absolutely crestfallen after the win. And by contrast, Pablo Carreño Busta, he looked like he had a fun night in Montreal last night. He looked like a man that had thought, it's taken me 31 years to get here. I've spent 10 years playing in the greatest generation of male tennis players there has ever been, and finally I've got an opening and I am going to party. And yeah, it was one of those sort of, they did a split screen of champion and runner up, and it was a stark contrast.
Well, and that's what you want it to look like, really, at the end. I do anyway. I want to see the difference that victory and defeat makes to a couple of tennis players, much as I want to see good sportsmanship as well. But I wonder whether maybe there's a flip side to that doubles conversation that we've just been having about Coco Gauff, that Hubert Hurkacz played doubles all the way to the semis. He played exclusively three set matches in the singles to get to this point. Great week, you know, he had three set wins over Ramos Vinolas and Kyrgios and Rude, and all of them went three sets. I wonder whether he ran out of gas a bit with all the doubles as well. It's a heck of a lot of tennis, and because it's condensed into a week and you don't have those rest days, I don't know. I do not know how they do it, really, when they're trying to back up singles and doubles wins like that. But yeah, it's coming into the match, I would probably have made Hurkacz favourite, but let's be honest, I'd probably make most of Pablo Carreño Busta's opponents the favourite in all the matches he plays against top 20 opponents. And I feel bad about it when I actually watch him play, because I tend to be reminded about how good he actually is, particularly as an opponent against a big hitting player. He's so good at counterpunching. He's so good at upsetting the narrative, really. If you think of him beating Djokovic in the bronze medal match, I always remember him beating Denis Shapovalov when Shapovalov was really making his first strides on the tour at the US Open. Classic five setter, but Carreño Busta just suddenly finds some inspirational tennis, and he's done that all week long. I mean, his run of form, beating Berrettini and Rune and Sinner, and then beating the two Brits back to back, it's been great stuff from him, and in not a very good year, as he said after his Dan Evans match. I was really taken by the way he said, you know, I haven't had a very good year, to be honest. So this is really, really nice.
Yeah, I think he was down about 30 in El Race, given that he's Spanish. We can use
You're
the
big
Nadal
on El Race today, man.
I am. And now he's up to 11. You know, it just this 1 week has shot him up. And I think we saw a bit of that in his reaction. I think he... You know, the best week of your life coming at a time when you don't necessarily expect it, I think is going to be quite a powerful emotion. And it was brilliant to see his reaction. He leapt in the air. He was so happy. And it kind of reminded me of the scenes when he won the bronze medal. And I always remember him saying, this bronze is like gold to me. And you felt that. And you felt that here as well. And honestly, it seemed like, maybe for 1 week only, or maybe he will take a lot of confidence from this, but he grew some fangs this week. You know, I often think of Pablo Carreño Busta as, yes, he's a brilliant competitor and he makes it very, very tough for top players to beat him, but he can be a bit of a choker. You know, he can lose matches from match point up. He can very often fail to serve out sets, or he's got a really bad record in Madrid, you know, in his sort of home tournament. He doesn't always like that pressure, and yet this week he was just ruthless, and as you said earlier, kind of a bit of a killer. You know, whenever he got a chance, he just took it. And you know, I reeled off a list of players remaining in the draw on Thursday's podcast. I think we were down to the last 16 stage, and I was talking about why I felt like it was quite a intriguing selection of players left, and I named practically everyone in the draw apart from Pablo Carreño Busta. I did that classic thing of being really sort of unfair to him, and yet in hindsight he had beaten Berrettini at that stage, and that was a really eye-catching scoreline, and I think showed that he was in brilliant form. And yeah, it's an amazing week for him. And I have to mention that one point in the final set of the final. Honestly, one of the points of the year where he scrambled back and hit a really high lob over his head. He was running at full pelt and he slammed into the back wall. He was running so fast, but he'd got the lob so high that it bounced really high, and Hurkacz kind of misjudged it, smashed it straight back to Krenyabusta. The rally carried on. Krenyabusta ended up at the net, won it with a backhand smash, and it was just an amazing sort of highlight moment. And from that point on, there was just no stopping Krenyabusta.
Yeah, I found this week incredibly discombobulating because Pablo Krenyabusta is 31 years old. We have known him for a long time, and, you know, I've got him firmly filed away in a certain place in my brain, and that is, you know what you're getting from Pablo Krenyabusta. Great play, exactly as you just described, Matt. Not going to give you anything, keeps you honest, but he's not a streaky player. He's a week-in, week-out player, and he's not a highlights reel player. Well, we've had pretty much the point of the year from Pablo Krenyabusta and this incredible one-week inspired run out of nowhere from him. This is not the Pablo Krenyabusta I know. I feel very, very discombobulated by it, and I don't know what to do with it. Is he in the US Open mix?
No, he's not.
Well, hang on. This let's assume that this is a Novak Djokovic free US Open, and I know there's been a statement from what department is it? I don't know. Whoever's doing the COVID related policies for US border control.
CDC
saying they're going to look at laxening their policies in the coming weeks. Well, there's a week and a half now before the US Open draw, so I still think it's looking unlikely, but anything can happen. But anyway, as it stands at the moment, Djokovic free US Open. Nobody else is in form that makes you feel particularly confident. Nadal is a totally unknown quantity. Convince me that Pablo Krenyabusta, two-time US Open semi-finalist, is definitely not in the US Open mix.
Well, I'll ask you a simple question. Would you be surprised if Pablo Krenyabusta
won
the US
Open? I'm doing presenting, David, and playing devil's advocate.
Well, I mean, that's all that it comes down to in the end for me, and that's why Simona Halep is in the mix for me, because I really like the definition we have for the mix. And look, I have spent the last decade underestimating this guy, and yet I'm going to continue to do it. but I mean, look, I think what it comes down to is the sheer beauty of sport. I do the same as you, Catherine. I file away a player under a little tag in my brain as to what they are. But sport can produce moments, can produce inspiration, can see somebody find form that they've never found before and make you think that they're someone that you didn't think they were. But it can just be a week. It can. And he's had that. Maybe he can repeat it. I'd be surprised if it happens. It hasn't happened in the last 10 years at this level of event before. So good for him. But I suspect this is probably not going to be replicated anytime soon.
What I would say, hopefully in an attempt to make you both feel better about filing Krenyabusta away, is how do you think Nick Kyrgios is feeling right now, who famously tweeted a couple of years ago, if clay didn't exist, dude wouldn't have even been close to top 50, about Pablo Krenyabusta, which is just a total misinterpretation of Pablo Krenyabusta's career. By that point, he'd already reached...
All of his best results have come on hard, haven't they?
Totally. He'd already reached the US Open semi-final at that point. He reached another one since then. He's an Olympic bronze medalist on a hard court. He's a very, very good hard court player. So, yeah. I always just think back to that tweet whenever Krenyabusta does well.
And P.S. Casper Ruud, a semi-finalist in Montreal as well. It's been a bad week for Nick Kyrgios's historic tweets.
Yes,
I would say
Borna Coric is going to go and beat Rafa Nadal next week.
Hubert Hurkacz in the US Open mix? Question mark.
That's more borderline. I would still say no, but it's much, much more borderline.
So who's in the mix?
Ooh, not many
people. Medvedev and Nadal?
Pretty much.
Nadal, who we haven't seen play.
He's
since...
still Nadal. I know that's...
Yeah, no, of course he's in with that, you know, he could arrive on one leg. And I mean, he practically did win the French Open on one leg, zombie foot. Of course he's in the mix, but it's a very non-definitive. Is it we quite often do individual versus the field. What about mix against the field? The US, if the mix is Medvedev and Nadal,
I'd take them.
You take Medvedev and Nadal over the field.
Yeah.
Matt?
You see, I think my mix is bigger than
PS
that.
Matt. Oh, and is Hurkacz in it?
Who's in it?
Oh, gosh. I've said that and now I've got to back it up, haven't I?
yes,
with
you
names.
Have.
Well, look, we've still got Cincinnati. I think Cincinnati can change things. A good week for Alcaraz in Cincinnati. I'd probably find myself putting him in there. Berrettini plays well in slams and at the US Open. That's my big thing about Hurkacz. He had that one run at Wimbledon. He's not been good in slams at all. He's been really poor other than that one run at Wimbledon. So that makes me question him.
He also looked like he was about to slip into a sexy French depression after defeat yesterday. He really wasn't in a good way.
Who else is in the mix?
Is Tsitsipas in the mix?
Should be, but... I'm not sure he is at the moment.
Do you take history over form?
Mm,
is Alcaraz not in your mix, David?
Alcaraz?
Yeah.
I don't think he is at the moment. I would need to see something new that we haven't seen since Madrid.
Okay.
He isn't giving me confidence at the moment. And look, doesn't change his long-term prospects for me whatsoever. I just think he's got something he needs to work out at the moment.
Still
Kyrgios
think
in your mix?
I was going to say, still think Kyrgios might be in my mix, you know.
David?
Borderline, and probably veering towards not being.
He might be in your little mix.
Yeah. If I can have a little mix, I'll put him and Hurkacz in together for a little chat.
Dan Evans had a good week, didn't he? David, Solihull correspondent.
Yeah. Oh, I did watch all of his last three matches just so closely because, look, he played great tennis and I think probably the best sustained tennis of his career. We've seen him play some brilliant matches, but he backed them up here. I mean, I think you were watching the same time as I was that Tommy Paul match, Catherine, and it was just the type of match that makes you want to wake people up to tell them to watch with you because it was so much fun. Tommy Paul's a player who is so much more than I thought he was going to be. That these two were just playing this dynamic all over the court type of match. Some players match up really well. I think Dan Evans matches up well against a lot of players to create good tennis matches. He created a great tennis match against Corinna Buster. Those two were just bouncing off one another, and Evans, the serve looked more reliable than I've seen it. The forehand was doing damage and looked more reliable than I've seen it. He just looks in a brilliant vein of form. And obviously, you know, went on to reach the doubles final. And again, I think that there is that question mark over a player of his ranking as to how much you can expend. How much have you got in the tank to have a deep run at a tournament and have a deep run in the doubles and then still do it again the next week and still be a threat to go into the second week of a slam? He's slightly found that balance quite tricky, I think. Which do you target, or do you not bother? Do you just play it all on its merits? But in terms of form, I thought he was a joy to watch and he played brilliantly.
Yeah, he gave me so many fun times this week. I felt like I want Dan Evans to be involved in every tennis match I ever watch this week because it was just electrifying. I loved it. Thank
Canada
you, Dan.
Canada loved him, didn't they? I mean,
yeah.
They loved
Canada,
everybody.
Canada can do that to players.
What
I remember
a great
Medvedev,
crowd.
Medvedev's run to the final when he ended up losing to Nadal in 2019. They really just took to him, I think, because obviously he's a French speaker, started doing all his interviews in French, and they they just took to him, and it was electrifying. You mentioned the doubles final, David, won by Neil Skubsky and Wesley Kulhoff in a match tiebreak over Dan Evans and John Peers. And it's their sixth title of the year. They've just, you know, scratched pairing at the start of this year, and they've just become winning machines. And incredible stuff from then. As things stand, Neil Skubsky has not been selected in today's Davis Cup team for Great Britain for this September group stage matches with the United States, Kazakhstan and the Netherlands. The team that's been announced is Cam Norrie, Dan Evans, Andy Murray and Joe Salisbury. A fifth player will be selected in the coming weeks. So watch this space. Cincinnati, folks. All sorts of interesting things have happened in the women's draw. Iga Świątek, Garbiñe Muguruza, Paula Badosa, Ons Jabeur are the top four seeds in the top half, which also has Coco Gauff and Simona Halep in there. You've got a round one of Elena Rybakina versus Maya Sharif, winner to face Garbiñe Muguruza. Haddad Maia against Ostapenko is a round one. Yes, please.
Oof, want to see that.
Veronika Kudermetova against Barbora Krejcikova, winner to face Mukova or Halep. Bottom half, you've got Kontaveit, Pegula, Sakkari and Sabalenka. First round of Karolina Pliskova against Venus Williams. Amanda Anisimova against Daria Kazatkina. And Naomi Osaka against Zhong Shuai. Yes, please, to all of it. But, folks, but the draw gods really have smiled upon us, because we have Emma Raducanu against Serena Williams in round one. And such is the excitement around this that the scheduling gods have got a bit high on life. And it was originally scheduled for first match Monday night, tonight, midnight tonight. I had it in my iCal, folks. and it's now mysteriously disappeared from the schedule today and will be played tomorrow. Much to the disappointment of the many, many tennis fans in the Mason, Ohio area who rushed to get tickets for Monday. They'll still get a great schedule of play, but they won't get Raducanu Williams, which is just feed it into my veins. I cannot wait. What a treat. What an absolute treat. And I really hope Emma Raducanu can see this as the win-win that it is.
Yeah.
She gets to, there are so many players, we talked about it on Thursday, didn't we, that haven't ever gotten to play Serena Williams and most likely won't. Iga Świątek has never had the chance to play the greatest player of all time, and that's such a shame for her and for us. Emma Raducanu is going to get that chance, and I think that is wonderful for her. And in terms of the match, if she loses, she's lost to the greatest of all time. If she wins, she's beaten the greatest of all time. It is win-win. And I know there's going to be a lot of takes out there, no matter what happens, that don't look at it like that. But I hope she ignores those takes.
Yeah. I think she will, Catherine. I think she'll relish it. I hope that nothing gets in the way. I hope that this delay of Monday to Tuesday isn't due to ill health for one of them or anything like that. I have no knowledge that it is, but I just hope that's the case. Of course, bit of a cock up, really, isn't it? Announcing or letting it be known publicly that match is going to be Monday night and it turns out to be Tuesday. Yes, it did rain yesterday quite a lot. I think a lot of matches were delayed, certainly in the qualifying and in the first round, so that may have been a knock on effect. I'm not exactly sure why, but you're right. I mean, to have a generational clash like this, which so nearly missed the boat before Serena Williams moved on in her life, it's a treat, and we should absolutely make the most of it.
I will make the most of it, David.
Even I might stay up for that.
I might make honey juices. I still have some frozen melon balls in my freezer from last year, from our semi-final lock-in. At Tennis Podcast Towers last year, Matt. I don't know how well frozen melon balls age, but let's find out. This feels like a perfect opportunity to find out. I will. I'm going to do that. I'm going to make honey juices. And I will take photos and put them on Instagram accordingly. The men's draw in Cincinnati. Top half, Medvedev, Rublev, Tsitsipas, Hurkacz. Also got Taylor Fritz, Matteo Berrettini. Is Taylor Fritz in the US Open mix?
No. Ooh, I was about to say he might be, you know.
You'd not be surprised if Taylor Fritz won the US Open.
I don't think I'd be that surprised. I mean,
I certainly think he's borderline.
I'd be gobsmacked.
Would you?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Indian Wells champion?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. We will revisit this, folks.
There's been a lot of Indian Wells champions who haven't won the US Open.
This is not over.
Sure. I'm not saying he would necessarily win the US Open, but what I'm saying is he might be in the mix. Gobsmacked. I'd be gobsmacked if... Who am I going to throw under the bus?
I'm excited for the next words out of your mouth, Matt.
Federico Del Bonis.
Come on. Honestly.
Imagine if Federico Del Bonis goes on to... I'm far more with Matt than I am with you. I would not be gobsmacked. I'm not putting him in my mix yet, but I'm considering it.
Oh,
I'll see what he does this week.
I want a definitive by the time we get around to...
Okay. Tommy Paul against Jensen Brooksby. Denis Shapovalov against Grigor Dimitrov. Kyrgios plays Alejandro Davidovich for Kina. Berrettini, Tiafoe, Sebastian Korda against Karen Khachanov. Those are all top half first round matches. Andy Murray's in the bottom half. He's got Stan Wawrinka. First round, Nadal is in there, Alcaraz, Casper Ruud, Felix Auger, Aliassime, who had an absolute shocker, incidentally, in his quarterfinal in Montreal. Having played brilliantly all week, just didn't show up, and it was a little bit alarming, actually. Nadal is a very interesting one this week, isn't he? Obviously, it's his first match on US hard courts. He'll face either Borna Coric or a qualifier in his first match, which they've already announced for Wednesday night. Unless it gets moved.
Expect that on Thursday.
He could return to world number one this week if he wins the title and Medvedev fails to reach the quarterfinals. So look, that's, I think, quite an unlikely set of scenarios, but it's possible. I think Alexander Zverev could get to world number one this week if a certain set of things transpires. Medvedev will keep the world number one ranking if he wins two matches. So, yeah, it's interesting. I don't think, you know, sometimes those sorts of, you know, a week when you could have three different players ending at world number one would be super exciting. But the rankings are so diminished at the moment that it does take something away, I think, from that storyline. But anyway, I'll still, you know, still on board the hype train. A reminder that you have one more week to enter our Wilson competition for US Open tickets there for the Louis Armstrong Stadium in the day session of Tuesday the 6th of September. You have to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast to be eligible to enter, and the link to do that is in our show notes. Thanks to everyone that's already entered. I think it's safe to say, judging by the number of entries, that people are pumped for this US Open. I certainly am. Somebody that doesn't look pumped but does look just utterly majestic is Willy the Cat, our mascot for this week. Willy was adopted in Long Beach, California, and is now living in Idaho. And I have to say, Willy is one of my favourite cats that we've ever had. I like Willy a lot. Willy's got that, you know, piss off everyone, this is my world and you're just living in it.
I can definitely see
look about
like him.
And that is one of my favourite things about cats, the sass.
Yes.
And Willy's definitely got the sass. Willy is clutching a tennis ball and he definitely doesn't want anyone to come near it. He's also, his fur looks so dense and soft, I just want to bury my head in it and use him as a pillow. So hello Willy. We'll pop a picture of Willy in our newsletter and on Instagram as well.
And Long Beach, California is where Billie Jean King was
born. Yes indeed. a cat of great pedigree. We have our mascots. David's got Darwin. I've got Carter. Matt has the dearly departed Gerald. Speaking of Billie Jean King, she and Alana Kloss sponsor Billie Jean, who's going on her holidays this week. We're all, the Whittaker family are off to Lymington on the south coast to celebrate my dad's 70th birthday.
Happy birthday, Mr.
Happy
Whittaker.
Birthday.
Happy birthday. Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner are our executive producers and top blokes. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Kazumi Motoike in Austin, Texas.
Oh, hello.
Right, Kazumi.
That's a great name, Kazumi. And Austin, Texas is on my would like to visit list. I would like to go to the music festival that they have there. Apparently it's a very urbane, metropolitan, vibesy city in perhaps a state that would not be described using any of those adjectives. It's a little oasis, I believe, and I would like to visit.
Me too. Thanks, Kazumi.
Thanks, Kazumi.
We've also got Simon Bell, who is in Ottawa in Canada.
Hello, Simon.
Hi, Simon.
Ottawa, well, very fitting to have a Canadian this week.
And Simon's provided us with some trivia about Ottawa.
Yes, please, Simon.
And more specifically about the Rideau Canal in Ottawa. It is apparently transformed every winter into the largest naturally frozen ice rink in the world. 7.8 kilometres long and a total maintained surface area of 165,621 metres squared, which is the equivalent to 90 Olympic-size skating rinks.
Wow. Well, pop that on my to-visit list as well. Can have a little skate down the canal.
Mm. How cool
Love
is that?
Love that. Thank you very much, Simon. Cheers, every day's a school day.
And finally today, we've got Mallory Mapes Couture, who is in Vermont, USA.
Love the name Mallory.
Right, Mallory.
So we've got a Canadian, an American, and an American, or two Americans. So we're following the tennis, the calendar.
Yes.
The tour.
Like Moller Mallory. The rival of Suzanne Longlen.
Oh, I was trying to think of where do I know that name? Mm. That's right.
Yeah. And Mallory says, I'm always listening and doing everything, really, with a 13-year-old long-haired dachshund named Cookie.
Oh, hello.
And Mallory says, our favourite recurring segments are David is excited about, Catherine is annoyed by American football. She says, thank you all for being a bright spot in some otherwise dark days. That was submitted about a year ago, so hopefully things have brightened a bit since then.
Oh, hope so, Mallory. Hello to you and to Cookie. We will be back, folks, on Thursday with a Midway Cincinnati podcast, when hopefully we'll be talking about Emma Raducanu against Serena Williams, if they've deigned to schedule it by that point, and plenty else besides. I'm pumped for this week. I'm almost approaching David Law levels of pumped. So we'll speak to you on Thursday. Subscribe to our newsletter, become a friend, leave us an iTunes review, all those things, and we will speak to you in a few days' time.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.